Can you hear me in the back? Yes. Hi, Berta McGinnis, Executive Director, Wilson House of East Dorset. Also the cook, also the housekeeper, also the bookkeeper. No, I have a small team of folks, but we are looking for a cook. So bear with us. We're doing well so far. Anyway, I want to welcome you to the Wilson House. How many of you have been here before? I see some familiar faces. Yes? Good. Great. We're glad to have you back. And if you haven't been, I know there's a great piece that talks all about Manchester, and you're going to go all the way through that this afternoon and see the sights. But the Wilson House, just very quickly, is a 501c3. We are supported by donations. Although we have been here for close to 35 years now, people assume perhaps that we have an endowment that keeps us going, and that is not the case. So we're grateful for donations. Think of us when you're thinking of legacy gifts, or you have family members who are thinking of legacy gifts. If you're thinking of a recurring donation, we do that as well. And in the meantime, we welcome 10,000 people to this house every year. You'll see people streaming through today that are just in the neighborhood or have come to East Dorset. You'll see people at the gravesite. You'll see people over at the library. So it's a very, very busy place. And being closed 10 of the last 15 months was a difficult situation for us. Because as you can see, this house hums when it has people. If it has no people, it's very quiet. And I spent the whole year here myself, but we had to furlough our staff. And it was very difficult. And here we are now with masks again. So we're hopeful that doesn't continue and that doesn't do something to our fall season. This is when we're very, very busy. But I want you to do a couple of things. I want you to take one of these home with you. Take many more home with you if you'd like. This is the best kept secret. You need to share your experience at the Wilson House with your home group, with someone you know. Please, that's the way we do business here. And we have an email list that is going around. I don't know, I started it back on that back row. So if it comes to you, please put your email. We're not going to bombard you with emails, but we do every couple of weeks a MailChimp newsletter. Just to let you know what's going on, just to let you know what seminars are coming up, something in the house. So it's a way to keep in touch. And we'll not, as I say, we'll not bombard you, and we don't share it with anybody else. So it's just coming from here. So I'm happy to take any questions. I'm not going to go into the history because I know Malcolm's got all of that in spades for you. Any questions about the house? Oh, I can't have covered it that well. Any questions about lunch? Okay, lunch is egg salad, tuna salad, ham, turkey, coleslaw, hummus, cookies. Okay? And I hope you're all staying for dinner. Is anybody not staying for dinner? Okay, good. Then we'll see you through the day. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm in my satellite office, which is the kitchen, so you'll be able to find me. Okay? Thank you, and thanks.
Thank you, Berta. One last quick thing. When we break at 5:30 and we go, we sit down for a sit-down dinner at 6 o'clock, and for those of you who didn't hear me last night, we'll all take a seat and pick your seat, and we'll start dinner with grace. And Steve, being our preeminent visitor, is going to lead us in grace in the dining room, and somebody will lead us with grace in the prayer room. But before we do that, when we break at 5:30, we take a group picture, and anybody who doesn't want to be in the group picture, that's cool. It's not a problem at all. But we all gather along the porch, okay, along the porch, and Kimberly's going to take a group picture. Okay, and then we'll get her in the picture and have a designated picture taker take it again. She has volunteered to take pictures, by the way, For if you're here with your group, for example, people from the firing line or people from the Wednesday night group, or you're just a couple and you want a picture, or you just want a picture in front of your sign, in front of the Wilson House sign, Kimberly is the designated photo taker, okay? And once again, anybody concerned with anonymity doesn't need to be in the group picture at all, okay? It's not something that gets shared around except to all of us. Okay? And on that note, I'm going to turn this over to the big guns.
Thank you. Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Berta. Thank you very much for being a wonderful host for all of us here at the Wilson House. This place really is, to some of us, this place is hallowed ground, and we really appreciate being here. So I was talking earlier with Steve. We're going to start moving through the steps a little bit, sharing our experience. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to read a couple of passages from our literature just to kind of set the stage. Last night we were talking about step one, really the problem. And my experience with step one was it really was an evolution. My first understanding was alcohol was killing me. But slowly, it started to dawn on me just how much trouble I was in. And a lot of that understanding came from moving through the steps. It came from the things that I was hearing in the meetings. It came from my sponsor. So it kind of just dawned on me how much trouble I was in. But what I want to do is I want to read a kind of seldom read piece. This was buried in Tradition 9, but I remember the first time I read it, I'm like, holy mackerel. So this is on page 174 of Tradition 9. It says, unless each AA member follows to the best of their ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, they almost certainly sign their own death warrant. You think he meant that? you know, was he maybe being extreme? It's been my experience that the people who really are, you know, real alcoholics that show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, if there isn't some form of spiritual practices that develop and a change in personality, they don't make it. You know, so Bill was this prophetic guy who saw problems before they even happened. And he really understood the nature of alcoholism. And he understood we can't just get sober and have everything go well if we're the type of alcoholic that this book describes. And then it says, their drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from their personal disobedience to spiritual principles. So there's not a lot of punishment in AA. You know, alcohol is the great punisher. But it's telling us here that our relapse is going to be because we're disobeying spiritual principles. Don't you feel somewhere inside you that that's true? That we really need to take stock of how we're behaving and the ways that we're thinking and our perceptions and everything, and we really need to start to look toward the spiritual. I know that's true. So that's a great problem statement for us. We're going to be in real trouble if we don't up our game. You know, this weekend kind of is about upping our game. So that's the problem statement. There's a great solution statement in the foreword to the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and I'll read that. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's one of my favorite pieces out of our literature. Let's unpack that a little bit. The 12 steps are a group of principles, and they're spiritual in their nature. And if we make an effort to practice them as a way of life, not only will they enable us to stay separated from alcohol because they'll expel that obsession that causes us to put alcohol into our body against our own self-interest. It will expel that. But the real good news is our life will change so much that we'll become happily and usefully whole. I don't know about anybody else, but when I was drinking, I was looking for alcohol to make me happily and usefully whole. And I became very useful when I was drinking at the bar. You know, if there was a surgeon sitting next to me, I'd give him some advice, you know? You know, what kind of scalpel you use, you know? What do you use that scalpel for? It didn't matter if I knew anything about it. You know, I had this drive to be useful. You know, my ego wanted me to be useful. And to be happy, I mean, in between the drinks, I was the exact opposite of happy. You know, they talk about restless, irritable, discontent. You know, that was on a good day for me. So I was looking for alcohol to bring me some kind of happiness. And in my personal experience, like, you know, I did a lot of alone drinking in the last years of my drinking. What would happen is somewhere between drink 7 and drink 9, you know, things would go like this. You know, I'd exhale all the way, all the emotional pressure and discomfort would kind of flow off of me. And for a moment or two, I would be happy. And then I'd overshoot the mark and become a vomiting pig. But what I was looking for was that sense of ease and comfort that the doctor's opinion talks about. I was looking for that. And this promise, basically, in the foreword to the 12 of 12 is saying that if we practice these 12 steps, these spiritual steps, we will become happily and usefully whole. And I'm here to testify to all of you today that I've become happily and usefully whole. I really have. My life is incredibly useful today, and I'm happy. And here it is. The big mistake I made in my life was trying to get happy arranging the externals, arranging where I was living, who I was with, you know, what my job was, what I was driving. And the happiness that's offered from the spiritual realm is an internal happiness. And I've experienced that. And what that's like is no matter what's going on out there, you know, people die, you lose jobs, you go bankrupt, states catch up with you because you fled to avoid prosecution. All those things happen to all of us, right? And, but no matter what those things are generating out there, there can be an internal comfort, an internal happiness. And that's just something that just absolutely has to be experienced. Now, just a little bit on step two, and then I'm gonna pass it over to Steve. But step two was an evolution for me. I did some coming to believe, you know, over a course of time. My first real glimpse of step two was maybe Alcoholics Anonymous has an answer for me. And then maybe, you know, getting a sponsor and a home group, maybe that's gonna have a real answer for me. And it developed over the course of time. It developed, over many, many different experiences, a lot of sponsorship and step work. It developed into a personal relationship with the divine, the consciousness of the presence of God. And that's a remarkable experience for somebody like me who was the most arrogant, judgmental, sarcastic, non-joining person you've ever seen in your life. I had a problem with things I didn't even have a problem with. That's how many problems I had. And for me to be able to move through that evolution, is remarkable to me. And I know you all had a lot to do with it. Me paying attention to what was going on with all of you in the meetings and with your own personal recovery had played a real role in it. But I am very glad that walking down into the basement to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, somebody did not meet me at the door with a list of the steps saying, this is what you have to do. You have to do it right now. This will establish a relationship with God for you, and that's what's going to solve your problem. Because if that would have happened, I would have said, thank you. That's great information. You know, good luck to all of you. That's not going to work for me. You know, I had to be led by the hand. You had to lead me by the hand into this coming to believe. But it's turned out to be an unbelievable experience for me. This coming to believe in a power that can pull me away from the gates of death and insanity of alcoholism. It's a power. The things that blocked me off from really believing in this power were my old belief systems. The things that I learned in Sunday school, the things that I just described in my mind. You know, when I say God today, something pops into your head that I don't mean. You know what I mean? It's really, really difficult to describe this power. And when I start to put descriptions on it, I put it in a box. It's a power that if I'm living life along certain spiritual principles, I can gain access to. If I'm living life based on selfishness and self-centeredness and self-involvement, I'm distant from. So these steps really have the steps and the sponsorship and the service commitments and everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has told me it would be a good idea if you did that, Chris, has changed me to the point where now this power is accessible to me. And it's absolutely, you know, revolutionized my life. And I see it revolutionizing your lives. You know, the actual power of God can work in you and through you. They don't even say that at church. You know what I mean? But that's really one of the promises that we have. The actual power of God can work in you and through you and do for you what you cannot do for yourself. And Steve, I want to hand it over to you, buddy.
As that, maybe I can just hold it here. As that unsuspected inner resource, right? And the idea of tapping into it, you know, really strikes me because that's like, it's like getting an IV, you know. When I get an IV, I don't know exactly why that's what's happening, but I feel differently, you know. And what happens when I get this conscious awareness, this God consciousness, there's an awareness. I experience life differently. I see things differently. And we'll talk about that more. But also, Chris talked about that, that wholeness. You know, how often do we hear someone show up at AA, or would you have heard me talk about that hole in the soul, right? H-O-L-E. But here we get W-H-O-L-E. That hole is filled. And that's also, like we said last night, I gotta get sober to get whole for me in AA. But that's been the gift, you know, and when Roland Hazard, you know, went to see Carl Jung, and ultimately Jung said, I can't help you, right? After a year and encouraged him to go get connected with some folks as he did with the Oxford groups. But when Bill wrote Carl Jung, you know, in 1960, 61, and Jung wrote back to Bill, you know, almost 30 years later, right? And he told Bill, he said, I couldn't be as, I'm paraphrasing, but I couldn't be as candid with Mr. Hazard as I might have been given the times. But he says, what I really thought he had at a low level was a spiritual thirst for wholeness. In medieval terms, a union with God. See, I show up here not knowing what's missing. I show up here not recognizing that what I really have is a spiritual thirst. And I've been trying to quench that with alcohol. I have been bringing about that change, a change in me through alcohol rather than this spiritual connection. You know, it says back in a vision for you, it talks about what most normal folks get from a few drinks, right? I mean, normal people, I get why they drink. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality. You know, I didn't even know what that meant for a long time, but I just love saying it. It just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Conviviality, joyous intimacy with friends, colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, and a feeling that life is good. A feeling that life is good. It goes on to say that that's not what a guy like me gets in the latter days of his drinking. What I get, it says maybe momentarily. So I'll get that feeling. As Chris said, maybe it's drink 4, 5, 6, 7. I don't know. Maybe it's at 8, 9, 10 at night. But I awaken to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. And then I give up this drinking and say, what do you got for me? You know, it's amazing that a guy like me, everything that alcohol did to me, even when I decide to put it down, it feels like a sacrifice. You know, I'm in this abusive relationship with alcohol, just like an abusive relationship with someone else. And I never want this to be misinterpreted. I'm not making light of that. But, you know, when I'm watching that bad TV movie of the week, and he or she is going back to him or her, and I'm watching and I'm going, don't do it. Don't you see? This is going to end badly. Do not do it. I don't get it. I'm watching and they go back. And I got this kind of relationship with alcohol and I would break up with alcohol. And then about 2 or 3 days later, I'd get an alcohol booty call. And alcohol would say, Steve, just let me come over. Let's just hang out. We'll just cuddle. And I go, okay. We have a couple of good nights together, and then it just beats the hell out of me again, right? And so it's amazing because what alcohol did for me was so remarkable and so needed that I was willing to risk what it did to me, but the scales had turned dramatically and the price I was paying, and perhaps more importantly, the price the people around me were paying, was going up significantly. But I don't understand that I've got this search for spiritual wholeness. I didn't even think in those terms. So when I get here, what the book says, you know, last night we talked about the problem a lot. And talked about both the problem with alcohol, that relationship with alcohol, and that relationship with me, and that relationship with you, and that relationship with God. You know, I was in a meeting a few years ago, and a guy came in late. That's not surprising. He decided to share immediately. That's not surprising. He didn't know what the topic was. That's not surprising for him or me. And he goes, but I gather from what I've heard that the topic is relationships. And it wasn't. But what struck me is, in fact, all of our meetings are about relationships. All of our meetings are about relationship. How do I relate myself rightly to him? How do I relate myself rightly to you? How do I relate myself rightly to me? All of this is about relationship. But I show up here with an alcohol problem. And then I finally come to grips with that problem with alcohol, right? And I finally, when we get to We Agnostics and, you know, I went through that, you know, assessment that I took going to treatment with you guys last night. But the men and women of AA let me know right away that how I answered those questions isn't what makes me alcoholic or non-alcoholic. Those are the types of questions that might reveal my alcoholism, that might be a red flag. But what I could finally grab hold of is what's on page 44 in our book when it says, you know, when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop entirely, which you guys explained meant to stop and never start again. Or when drinking, you have little control of the amount you take. So I said, so you're probably alcoholic. And I finally got where I could lay my life experience honestly over that litmus test with alcohol, the first half of the first step, and go, that's me, I got that. So I was able to concede to my innermost self, at least at the level I could understand the problem at the time, I got that. And then the next line said, if so, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. I thought, damn, I was hoping for something else. Because quite honestly, and the book talks about, we've seen many a man's eyes light up, right? When finally I'm with people who understand the problem. And then the solution is really off-putting. The solution, number one, I didn't think that, I didn't know if I believed in it. I didn't know if it was real. Was it accessible by me? I was a guy who, I don't know what I believed or didn't believe, but I wouldn't hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of meetings for the first 6 months I was sober. I went through my big book with a marker and blacked out everywhere it said spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. It looked like a CIA redacted volume of the big book. And I did that. I used to say with my sponsor's approval, and he said, no, you did it with my knowledge, but not my approval. Those are different. But what he had done was this language was so off-putting to me. And like Chris said, I wouldn't use the word God. And I wouldn't say God because I didn't want you to think I meant what I thought you meant when you said God. And I didn't, you know, you could pat me on the head all you want and say, oh, you get to, you know, pick whatever, oh, power of the universe, whatever, I get to make stuff up, but I knew what you meant. Hang around a little while and you'll believe like we believe. We'll bring you into the team. I wouldn't hold hands and say that Lord's Prayer, and a guy came up to me one night after the meeting, and the guy had been my counselor in treatment. And he said, Steve, you're still hung up on that. He said, how come you won't do that? And by the way, everyone in AA told me it was perfectly okay for me not to hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And I'm really grateful for that. And if you're there, that's perfectly all right. But he was trying to understand what my particular hang-up was. And I said, I don't want to be a hypocrite. You know, I said, I don't know what I believe, and I'm not just going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers because that's what you guys are doing. And he had heard my treatment fifth step, which included some of the things you guys heard last night, 6 DUIs. I hit a car going the wrong way down the interstate that injured and hospitalized people. I stole time and money from a family business or infidelities in my marriage. I had drunk at the hospital when my daughter was born. But he said, hypocrisy, that's where you draw the line, huh? Yeah. He said, that's really impressive, man. And he said, I got good news for you and bad news for you. And I said, I'll play. And I felt condescended to. And if you're new to AA and you have ever felt condescended to, it's because someone's just been condescending to you. I said, I'll play. What's the bad news? He said, the bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And you ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. And I said, what's the good news? He said, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will tell you, I'm just grateful for that today, maybe more so than I was then, right? But see, he was allowing me, what that allowed me to do, I didn't believe anything any differently, but it took some of my defenses down, and some of that was just a false bravado. I'm still trying to hold on to my version of my man card, you know, and I'm not, like the book says, I'm not going to be the hole in the donut. And I was taking stands and pushing back in places where people weren't even pushing against me, but I was looking for some things to fight about and debate and argue. And you guys just make it easy. There's nothing to fight about here. There's nothing to fight about. You know, Chris just said, see, we've made clear the first step is a description, I believe, of my problem. It just describes the problem, and I get to decide whether I've got it. That's the identification. The second step describes the solution. It's not where I get the solution. It describes what can happen to me, that ultimately a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And I kept thinking something was supposed to happen for me there. Now, it does happen. Bill had that sudden and vital spiritual experience, but that's why they put Appendix 2 in the book that says, hey, we may have given you the misimpression. I mean, that happened at the second printing. That's how quickly they saw that they might have left this impression with Bill's story. Don't be waiting on that burning bush. Just be willing to take these actions, and by the 12th step, I will have had this spiritual awakening. And what I believe or don't believe, that blank will be filled in as a result of the actions I take. And I will tell you, that's in pencil because that continues to evolve 32 years later. This relationship continues to evolve, just like my relationship with people. I learn more about you. We spend more time together. What I thought was true is not true about you. And this thing I didn't know about you, I now know. That happens with this relationship with this power greater than myself. And as Chris said, no one can fully define or comprehend this power, which is God. That's comforting to me. No one can fully define. Some of you may have heard the story about the blind men and the elephant, right? And it says, there were three men from Hindustan to learning much inclined. They went to see an elephant, but all of them were blind. One of them grabbed the elephant by the tail. One of them grabbed the elephant around its big leg. And the other one grabbed the elephant by its trunk. And they went back to their village, and the villagers, who also had never been around an elephant, said, tell us about the elephant. Tell us about the elephant. And the one who grabbed the elephant by the tail said, it's like a rope. And the one who grabbed it around its big leg said, it's like the trunk of a tree. And the one who grabbed it by its trunk said, it's like a snake. And they argued endlessly about what an elephant was, never realizing that the elephant was big enough to encompass all those traits. That they had not described the elephant, they had described their touch point, their relationship to the elephant. And see, I think that's what we do. So at a time when I was so uncomfortable about what I thought you thought, and I heard you describe something and I would go, oh, that's not my experience. I'm no longer put off by that at all. And I'm now freely use the word God because I'm unattached to what I think you think that means. I'm just fine with it now. And that used to be something that just made the hair on my neck stand up in a meeting. So you give me so much freedom here where I thought I was trapped at this second step. Because it says what once I say I've got that problem over alcohol, it says that that so lack of power is my dilemma. And see, I will tell you, this is again another point of view maybe not everyone holds, so I'll argue with no one. But I don't think lack of power is my problem. I think my problem is I don't know I don't have power. I think my problem is I keep trying to exert power I don't have to do something I can't do. First of all, in that relationship with alcohol, it says lack of power is my dilemma. And I was 18 years sober before I looked up the word dilemma. Among other things, it says it says a problem with two equally unacceptable solutions. Well, the fact that I don't have power presents me with a dilemma, and the book calls it out, whether to die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis. Whether to accept spiritual help or go on to the bitter end. Well, I'd like door number three, please. But see, all we got in AA, you know, and Chris said, when, you know, we talk about suggestions. And I'm a guy that I'm going to believe what's on one page of the book. I decide I believe what's on all the pages of the book. So I believe they are suggestions. It says in How It Works, following are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. On 164, right, it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. By the way, just a quick aside, have you met the person who realized they know only a little? He's not in my home group. And I'm not him. And also, just another quick aside, aren't you glad they waited to page 164 to tell us that? If you led with, by the way, we want you to read this book, but just know up front, we don't know much. No, they sucked us all the way to 164. But says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. So while they are suggestions, here's the caveat in AA, it's the only suggestion we got. We don't have a second set of suggestions in Alcoholics Anonymous. So Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't claim ownership of the only way to get sober and be sober. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't suggest that we've got a monopoly on God. Alcoholics Anonymous, it says in working with others that if our man wants to try some other spiritual approach, we encourage him to follow his conscience. Keeping in mind, we have much in common, us alcoholics. But if I'm going to be in AA, I might as well do AA. See, there's nothing to argue about here. If I want to do something else, that's fine. AA's like a steak restaurant. We serve steak. If I go and ask for, you know, sushi, you know, Steve, you know, we serve steak. Well, I'd rather you serve sushi. Get some sushi. No, Steve, we serve steak. Now, we know a great sushi restaurant down the street. We will make you a reservation. We will give you a ride down there, and we hope that you enjoy your meal. And I say that without being a smart aleck or anything. We're just saying that, but if you're in AA, this is what we do. So there's nothing to argue about. And what we're trying to do is connect, is to find a power to come to believe in a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem, which will restore me to sanity, which will help me see things as they really are rather than my skewed version of things. So I thought I was stuck at that second step. I can't go forward because I don't believe, but you guys told me that's an evolution, as Chris said. I don't have to buy into this right now. In fact, the only thing that the second step says to me is, do you now believe or are you even willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself? If so, we can assure a man he's on his way. We can say with assurance, if you'll just say, you know what, yeah, I'm skeptical, I'm cynical, but I'm willing to give it a shot. And the way we do that is by continuing to move forward. And because if I really conceded to that first step, as we talked about it, it says over here on page 43, right, that the very last of kind of, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. When it says once more, it says, Steve, we've been telling you and telling you and telling you. But once more before you move on, do you buy into the fact that you got a problem you can't solve? You can't outread it. You can't outthink it. You can't outtalk it. You can't outlearn it. You're going to have to be, what Chris said, changed from the inside out. We're not in the information business. We're in the transformation business. And that's an internal transformation. It is an entire psychic change, which is that spiritual awakening, which to me means I begin to see things as they really are. I'll tell this and then give it back to Chris. By the way, I'm just going to set the stage for you if you hear this later in the day. The two most often told lies in Alcoholics Anonymous are, I'll be brief, and I'll end with this. And you know, in your home group, when you hear that, strap in. We're going to be here a while, all right? So, same warning for me. But when the movie Avatar came out a number of years ago, right? That was sort of the reintroduction of the 3D technology that I had not seen for years. And my wife and daughter wanted to go, and so we go and we go to the big IMAX theater, and I become fascinated by this 3D technology, because I put these glasses on and take the glasses off and watch the movie. And when the glasses are off, it's two-dimensional, right? It's height and width. And it's kind of fuzzy. And I put the glasses on, and oh, now it's clearer. There's depth. I'm seeing things I could not see without the glasses on. They're there. The movie's the same. The dialogue is the same. The story is the same. Everything's there. But until I put the glasses on and add the third dimension, I can't see these things. It enriches my experience. It gives clarity. And now we're here in a three-dimensional world, but I'm looking to be rocketed into a fourth dimension. And when I am connected to that power, when I'm spiritually awakened, I see things. They were there. I see things in a way I did not see them. I experience things in a way I was not experiencing. They're there. You've added this fourth dimension and a vital sixth sense. And it just changes the world that I'm in. It doesn't change what's happening. It changes, this is what's going on. Oh, there you are. I didn't see you like that before. I could not see things from that entirely different angle. Oh. And I don't know that, and the truth is, my glasses today are on and off all day long. I'm like that bad lamp in your house that blinks, you know, and you start walking toward it, it comes back on. You walk away and it goes off. That's my spiritual connection, or my awareness of that connection, is off and on all day long. Chris.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Steve. That was great. I want to tell a story before I get started here. So Bill Wilson was born in this house, and he was born on a couch up in the back living room, back 18 whatever. And so when Bonnie and Ozzy got a hold of this place, one of the first things they did was they put a perpetual light up right in the spot where he's born. You can see that perpetual light. It's the one with the big ornate shade on it. And we were up here about 10 years ago, on a workshop, and this light doesn't have a switch. It's always on. And Bonnie comes walking, and we're all sitting around. Bonnie comes walking in and she goes, "Oh, the light's out. The perpetual light's out." And we look, and one of our home group members had unplugged it to charge their phone. is that great? For some reason, I think Bill would get a kick out of that. You know what I mean? God, Steve was covering some great, great stuff, great insight into this process. So the book is so beautifully laid out. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe that there's a power that can solve what our real problem is? And then it starts to really describe at an even deeper level, you know, what our problem is. And there's language between page 60 and 63 that talks about selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the root of our problem. We must be rid of this selfishness or it kills us. And it gives some brief descriptions of how selfishness and self-centeredness can really be impacting our lives. Now, I've been that way forever. So it was really hard for me to identify with this stuff. Like if you would have come up to me in the first 6 months and said, "Chris, selfishness and self-centeredness is going to kill you," I'd be like, "I'm not selfish." I mean, I was so selfish I didn't think I was selfish. And really what it was a mind that reacted to the world based on what is going to impact me and how is it going to impact me. And this overwhelming selfishness like directed my life. And then it talks about being the actor who wants to run the whole show. And I was that guy. I would get really frustrated when things weren't going the way I thought they should go. I had a lot of problems with employment because of that. I would always know that this is being run wrong. Why did the boss set it up this way? I would have set it up that way. I mean, so it caused a lot of problems in my employment relationships. In my romantic relationships, I would go into a relationship like that thinking,
this is going to make me feel good. This is going to be good for me. You know, she's going to treat me really well. And it would never work out. Just because of the way I'm going in a selfish way. My friendships, pretty much all blew up. Somewhere along the line, I was disrespected. You know, somewhere along the line, I was treated poorly. And if you look at my life, in high school, maybe there was 20 or 30 good friends. As I moved through my alcoholism, it got smaller and smaller and smaller. And the crazy thing is that these guys, I think through the Oxford group, but Bill Wilson also was a huge reader. He read a monstrous amount of literature. And he talked to some really, really smart people. They were able to hone in on really what our problem is. It's certainly a disconnection and problems in relationships that are based on this selfish and self-centered worldview. But in step three, my first understandings of step three was, let's just say the prayer and let's move on to step four. And a couple of my experiences, and unfortunately some of the early sponsees that I worked with, that's what we would do. We'd say the third step prayer. Okay, that's done. That's taken care of. Let's move into step four. And over the course of time, I've really seen that a thoroughness to the principles of these steps is really of benefit moving through these steps. Because I think what kills so many of us is lack of enthusiasm, certainly, but being somewhere in the process and stalling out. Just stalling out, not moving forward. I've worked with a lot of people. I was the contact person for a lot of the local treatment centers in the 90s. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of people, and not everybody, you know, moves through the steps and has an awakened spirit and is, you know, in the Wilson house, you know, hanging out with us. There's a lot of people that drop off along the way. And have you ever worked with somebody and in the middle of the step work, it's almost like they say, I'm good now. I got this. You know, I got this. Sometimes I feel like, you know, what have I missed? What did I not communicate? Was it some way I fell short in presenting this material? Or was it just, you know, someone that wasn't ready or was unwilling or whatever? But something that's really, really beneficial is what they call surrender. You know, surrender. Are you done? Are you done with this stuff? Now, very, very few people I've worked with have been at that point where they would absolutely do anything. You know, desperate to recover. Many people come in today, that don't have that sense of desperation. And as a sponsor or a spiritual advisor, what I've tried to do over the years is really try to hone my communication skill. My ability to transmit an idea. And the base idea was what Steve was talking about. You have a problem you can't solve. You know, that's the basic communication in the very beginning. And we have a way out upon which we can all agree. And here it is. But there's something in alcoholism. And I believe it's based in self. It's based in selfishness and self-centeredness that makes so many people reluctant to believe, reluctant to participate, reluctant to engage in this recovery process. So, you know, over the course of years, I've really tried to get better at communicating and relating and identifying. Now, in my early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, the step work was more enigmatic. Okay, in North Jersey, when I got sober, it was unheard of for somebody to bring somebody over to their house and take them through the 12 steps. Literally, if someone was doing that, they would have been labeled a pervert. It was that unorthodox, you know, to have your sponsees come over your house and go through the steps. It was just unheard of. So the experience that people were undergoing at that period of time were meetings, were step meetings, were speaker meetings, and their own reading of the literature. So I went through that period of time, and then I discovered some workshops, which really made things much more clear to me. The first was the Joe and Charlie workshops. They were really impactful. The Joe Hawk Salvation Army talks, those were going around. That was really impactful. Haven't been able to listen to those in a long time. But that created the renaissance, really, of literature-based, big book-based presentation type of experiences that we're somewhat having, here today at the Wilson House. And when I got involved in that, I was encouraged by the information. I gave some authenticity to the people that were giving these workshops because they spoke with such authority. And the truth, you know, it's really hard sometimes to deny the truth of alcoholism if you're really, really honest about it. And so there was honesty and there was authority in these workshops. And I wanted what they had. You know, I wanted what these people had. So I got started on a very, very imperfect movement through the 12 steps. Multiple times I've been through the steps, and that's a good thing because of the poor job that I did, you know, in a lot of the early attempts through the 12 steps. But I believe today, in the third step, the step one, the problem, step two, the solution, readies us. If we really are clear with this experience that we're having, it readies us for a decision, and that decision is to live life along spiritual lines, to seek a relationship with God, to follow to the best of our ability the spiritual nature of the 12 steps, and to distance ourselves from this toxic experience of selfishness and self-centeredness. And that third step decision, when you look back at the history of, in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in the Akron area, there's a lot of writings that describe how Dr. Bob took you through the third step. And, it was abbreviated compared to, you know, some of the stuff we go through with the big book today. They didn't really have the big book at that period of time. But it would be on your knees in front of a bunch of guys in Dr. Bob's house. And if he didn't think you were sincere enough in expression of turning your will and your life over to the care of God, if he didn't think you were sincere enough, they'd make you do it again. It was a serious decision. The definitions of words have changed over the years. A lot of people use period dictionaries now when they're doing the real deep big book studies because the definitions of words have a tendency to change, you know, from the 30s to today. But I believe when they when they called something a decision back then, it was really serious. Like I can decide to go get a sandwich up at the convenience store right for lunch, but something could happen and I could not do it. That wouldn't be the type of decision they were talking about back in the 30s. When you made a decision, they expected you to now mean business. That's kind of some of the language they would use. This guy means business. And that's someone who is going to start on the spiritual process of the 12 steps, or the early version of the 12 steps that came out of the Oxford group. But from a place of sanity, if I've truly conceded to my innermost self that I've got a problem I can't solve, I've come to believe that there's a solution for that problem. From a place of sanity, I have to be ready to make a decision to move into that solution. But we're alcoholic. You know, there's sometimes there's some things that really, really trip us up. And I think that's where good sponsorship, can really help. That's what I got, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. You know, as Chris, I love the way the book is laid out as well, right? I mean, we got the doctor's opinion, and, you know, when they got Silkworth to write that letter, it was really to give credibility to the book, right? They're going to mail this book out. It's not like they, you know, they're sending it out to clergy and doctors and stuff. They didn't have a list of alcoholics to send it out to. And they wanted it to have some credibility. And when I was first introduced to the book, the first two chapters I read sitting in treatment the first night was the doctor's opinion. And there is a solution. I said, we'll get this covered quick and I'll be out of here. But we get that doctor's opinion. Then Bill shares, gives us that chance for identification by sharing his story, right? And then it gives us, there's a solution before I panic. And then it says, before you get too cocky, here's a little more about alcoholism. And then, now if you're interested, here's how, you know, then we acknowledge, and we go, now here's how it works. Here's how this thing works. And I'm encouraged, and it's not lost on me, the things I see today. And as Chris said, we want to take, you know, I envision taking a step and moving on. But the truth is, we take these steps with us into the next step. These are not, they're numbered, but they're not independent. They're not standalone. They're interconnected. Everything about the spiritual threads of our program are all connected. When they're not done, we can't go down the buffet line and do a 1 and a 4 and a 7. You know, you can't do one without the context of the others. At least that feels like my experience. But as I'm moving toward, so we've described the problem and described the solution, and then we're told here's how it works. And then for the first time that I see in the book, they beg me. It says, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. And I used to, you know, debate with my sponsor at about 3 years sober. We're having the debate because now, and we can fall guilty of this here, at about 3 years sober, not only had I read and studied the book, I might have been one of a handful of people that really understood it. And I began telling people what Bill meant to say. And we can turn this spiritual, you know, gathering into an intellectual exercise. And I have to guard against that. We can begin parsing words to a point that we've lost the spiritual nature of what this is. And we want to have an experience, not get an A on the test, you know. But I still fall back and forth into those things. But if I'm going to really move forward, and part of that third step is this decision to let go of old ideas. And all that means is, it doesn't mean, because the debate with my sponsor was, well, That sounds like I never had a good idea before I got to AA, that everything I ever thought was wrong. And he said, that's not true, Steve. He said, I'm sure you got some good ideas. He said, we've not heard any of them yet, but I'm sure you've got some. He said, but really what you're being asked to do there is not cling too tightly to the only ideas you had when you showed up here. Doesn't mean they're all wrong. He said, you have trouble distinguishing the good ideas from the bad ideas. They're commingled with you. He says, and if you are just limited to the ideas you showed up at AA with, then there's not room for any new ideas. So AA's not telling you to throw them away. It's just to set them down. So your hands are free. Open your mind so your mind is free for some new ideas that might serve you better, might help you serve others better. He said, if you'll go through the process of these steps, the truth will find its way back. The good ideas will still be there. And see, and I've been running my life based on some beliefs, and I couldn't have even told you what they were in many cases. The old ideas that had me, you know, the story about myself. Part of the old ideas is we got to let go of what we think we know. And be open to what might show up. And then I get to this third step, right? And I love what Chris said about enthusiasm. Because it's only a few years ago that I paid attention. Now I'm about to parse a word. But I paid attention to where it says after this, you know, in the midst of this third step, when we sincerely took such a position. That's after it says when I decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. That he's the principal. That he's the father. I'm the child. Just when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of things began to happen. And apparently the sincerity of that position is not unimportant. I seem to benefit more when there is sincerity. Later it will say when we enthusiastically embraced certain ideas. So through no virtue, I have to tell you that I've been sincere and I've been enthusiastic since I've been in AA, and that's not virtue or intelligence, neither of which, thank God, are necessary for sobriety in AA. But I land here, and after deciding I got this problem I can't solve, and after becoming open-minded at a minimum in step two to the prospect that perhaps a power other than me, greater than me, can solve that problem. The third step is my decision to seek that solution to that problem. And to do so unreservedly. Not my version of that, you know. And as Chris said, what those few pages, 60 through 62, 63 in the big book do is introduce me to the fact, as it says, that selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my problem. Now we're going to go attack the problem at its root. When we quit drinking alcohol, that's like mowing over some weeds, but not weeding. You know, it looks better for a little while. Cosmetically, we've made some significant improvements. The curb appeal of my house just got a lot better because I mowed the grass. But by next week, that stuff's growing back up. I have not removed it. I've trimmed it a little bit. And so I stopped drinking, and now we're going to get to the root of the problem. And it says that root is self. Self is my problem. Self in its various manifestations. Chris talked about it last night. It will tell us in a couple of pages, being convinced that self in its various manifestations is what has defeated us, we looked for its common manifestations. That's what we're about to do when we go into the fourth step. We're going to inventory to see where self shows up in my resentments, in my fears, in my conduct. Where does self show up? I was in a meeting at that same beginner's meeting I referenced last night, a different meeting, but at that particular group. And there was a young girl in there, 16, 17 years old, and she was trying to get sober, and I knew her, and my wife sponsored her mom. But in that meeting, all the people with 6 months or less are asked to kind of check in, right? And it got around to her, and she started trying to say something, and she was stumbling and bumbling, and And finally she just stopped and she said, I just got to get over myself. And I thought, me too, baby, me too, you know, me too. That's what I'm trying to do is just get over yourself. Because this self, I'm trying to make this third step is where you have encouraged me as part of my recovery to turn away from self toward God, to go from a self-centered life to a God-centered life, to go from an egocentric driven life to a God-centric life, to a spiritually driven life, guided life, that, oh, this is the old idea. Now I'm changing from the fact that now I'm encouraged to stop taking actions based on what I think and what I feel and start taking actions based on the principles outlined in Alcoholics Anonymous, beginning again with the fourth step. And you say and at the end of that third step prayer, right, I'm asking in that prayer for, you know, first of all, I'm saying, do with me as you will. Yeah, don't blow by that one, okay? Yeah, do whatever you want to me. Do you really mean that? But please, here's a list of things I hope you won't consider. And you know what this list is? We'll see this list in a little while. This list of things that I don't even know I've written down is my fear list in the four-step inventory. Things that must happen or things that can't happen, and that's when I break my covenant with this third step. It's when I've got a list of stuff I don't trust God with. And I still got one, by the way. It's ever changing, but I get, you know, wrapped up in it. And then I'm praying, I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. When I first began to read that prayer years ago and pray that prayer, I had this mental picture of self being held hostage. But in fact, today I believe that self is the hostage taker. I'm in bondage of self. And that self shows up in these manifestations in many ways like the seven deadly sins. That self shows up as pride, as lust, as greed, as sloth, as envy. You know, and it's almost like they're holding me hostage, right? And they work in shifts, you know? Lust and greed have me for a while, and they do about a 4 or 5 hour shift, and then they go, look, we gotta go get something to eat. Hey, greed, would you take over for a while and drive the boat here, and then I'm done with that, and then sloth, I love sloth, and says, me and sloth just hang out and don't do shit together, but you know what, and I don't even know, see, but that's guiding my life when we begin to look, we're saying, what are your motives? Well, my motive is what drives you to action. A motive is what moves you to action, and fear will move me to action. Greed, lust, envy, sloth, those things will dictate what I do. And you're encouraging me here, this third step is my commitment to, with God's help, to do what I can't do by myself, to live by these principles rather than be driven by those feelings. And at the end of that prayer, it says, which is one of the great bait and switch moments in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I'd read ahead if I were you before. Cause it's after the prayer that it says we thought well before taking this important step. And I go, oh, dude, you know, it's like your buddy ever give you, you know, hey, I just took the pill. Oh, Steve, let me tell you what that's going to do. Right? Cause I take it and I go, look, dude, am I getting ready to take a nap or are we going somewhere, you know? But I take that prayer and then you go, oh, you should have thought before taking that. Asking yourself if you are ready to abandon yourself, abandon self utterly to Him. This is where I'm abandoning ship. I'm saying I'm giving up on me. I'm turning away from me toward God. I'm abandoning myself utterly. Not that Bush League switch, you know, pinch hitter. But no, utterly. Do with me as you will. That's frightening. I gotta tell you. It's daunting. Do with me as you will. And then I hand God a list of suggestions. Do with me as you will, except in my marriage. Don't be screwing around with my marriage. I'll handle the banking, God, unless you're going to endorse a check. I'm all for having more, but not for having less. You know the biggest joke that alcoholics say all the time? We don't like change. Bullshit. We just want to be in charge of the change. I got a lot of stuff I'd change if you put me in charge. I'll take a promotion. I don't want a demotion. I'll take a raise. I don't want you to cut my salary. You know? I'll move to a bigger house. I don't want to move to the apartment. I'll get a nice, you know, so I got a list. And here is where in its perfect incarnation, I give up the list making. Later in the 12 and 12, it will say, we all know the difference in a simple request and a demand. And I will tell you that I absolutely know the difference in a simple request and a demand, but I am often not aware when a request has morphed into a demand and I didn't even see it happen. Or that thing I hoped would happen now must happen. Or that thing I hope does not happen absolutely cannot happen or I won't be okay. And when I make those definitive conclusions for myself, I'm now held hostage to them. I'm a prisoner to what I've decided must or must not happen. The third step has given me some freedom here. But the third step, as Chris said, and as we close here, is in its simplest form, is me making that decision to embark on the process unreservedly to take the actions that you're outlining that will connect me to this power. It is, I told you last night, give me directions to New York, right? Now you've given me the directions, and I get about 15 miles down the road and go, this couldn't be right. I'm not turning left here. Ben and I were coming here yesterday from Albany, and he said, you know, Google turned us down this road, and we said, this couldn't possibly be right. And usually when I'm by myself, Ben and I'm sure just, you know, we followed the directions, but normally I'll just turn another direction, and God works just like Google Maps, you know. He just goes, you know, rerouting. Doesn't yell at me or anything, just goes rerouting. Go 1.3 miles and then turn left, you know. And I get these chances all as I go through. And again, God doesn't get mad at me. I don't get put in the penalty box. I don't get punished for those mistakes. I get lost on my own. And God's ready the moment I am. The moment I am. I pissed God off, so he's going to put me in the penalty box. I got a 6 month in purgatory before I win my way back in. No, God's ready. This power, however you perceive it, this connection is available the very moment that I am surrendered in the way Chris talked about being surrendered. I give up. That's what William James said, right? That the single source of all great spiritual experiences is this total deflation of ego, of self. The book says we're embarking on this thing, but it says a price must be paid. The price we pay is the total destruction of self-centeredness. Now, that's why we're always going to be somewhere in the middle. We're human. That's the humanness of us, that we're not absent ego, but we do want to deflate ego. But ego will reinflate itself untethered if I'm not staying connected to this power. And so this third step is where I'm saying I'm in. Ben and I are driving here yesterday and he's talking about what the weekend is and never been to something like this. And I was so appreciative. He said, I'm in. I don't know what we're going to be doing, but I'm all the way in. Let's do whatever there is to do. And I'm the guy usually with my nose pressed against the window waiting or getting a seat where I can ease out of the room unnoticed. But getting all the way in. And the third step is my decision to get all the way in and go, okay, here we go. Not my version of the 12 steps. Let's go do what's written down here. Let me follow that sponsor. Let me do those things. And we will jump into that inventory later this afternoon or at 10:30, actually. It's when I'm going to start telling you about my sex life. And that's more a marketing tool to get you back. But it's I guess we're done.
All right, everybody, thank you. We'll break till, what time does it say on schedule, 10:30? We'll break till 10:30 and we'll reconvene in here. Thank you, everybody.